One of the popular narratives that emerged after the 2016 election, in light of Donald Trump's presidential victory, was that you just simply can't trust polls. This idea was delivered a significant setback in 2018 when pollsters did an excellent job capturing the blue wave across the country. But questions have popped up again about the quality of political polling, largely driven by Joe Biden's narrow victories in states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, and the surprising inroads Republicans made in the House of Representatives. To consider how pollsters did in 2020, we spoke Thursday afternoon to Don Levy, director of the Siena College Research Institute, a very highly regarded polling outfit known for its partnerships with the New York Times. So turning then to the question at hand, how are you assessing the work your political polls did this year? And based on those metrics, how did you do in 2020?
The short answer is we didn't do as well as the standard to which we aspire to. That said, polling in general and our polling in specific did not do as poorly as the popular narrative, some of which came from that election night process, pointed towards. So let me pull it apart, you know, with you for a second. You know, if you look at the polls that were done by Siena in partnership with the New York Times, as well as nine other highly regarded and relatively transparent pollsters, that include people like ABC, CNN, Fox, Marist, Quinnipiac, Monmouth, et cetera, there were 57 polls released in the 8 days leading up to the election, 57 polls by 10 different pollsters. Of those 57 polls, the margin in the polls in 53 of them overstated what appears to be Joe Biden's final margin. The other four polls were basically right on the number within about three-quarters of a point, leaning, so three-quarters of a point, all of which leaned to overstate President Trump in those races. But you could call those four polls exactly right. So given that there were no high-quality polls done by these well-known pollsters, including us, that overstated the president's margin, and 53 out of 57 that overstated former Vice President Biden's margin, you'd have to say, you know, there was some error, and that error was seemingly systemic. Now, it's especially interesting because we poll exclusively by telephone calls made to cell phones and landlines, drawing off of voter lists. Some of these other polls do what's known as RDD. We've discussed that.
Random digit dialing.
Exactly. And some of these others do IVR. That's the, in effect, what sounds like a robocall. It's a computer calling you saying, press 1 for Trump, press 2 for Biden.
Right.
Others do online panels. So you had multiple methodologies across these 10 pollsters, all of which landed on an error overwhelmingly in Biden's direction. Now, the overall error in those 57 polls was about 5 points. Our overall error was about 4.5 points. While that doesn't reach to the standard that we set for ourselves, it is substantial but not overwhelming error. Still, you know, I think this is something we have to look at, and we have to figure out how is it that in poll after poll, state after state, national polls, that there was a tendency to overstate Biden's margin. You know, if it's only by a couple of points outside, you know, one application of the margin of error, you know, we can say, oh, it was still a decent poll, still a good poll, but that's not how perhaps you or perhaps the general public perceive it. So how did that happen? You know, and there are multiple theories, all of which we are seeking to study and to test. But, you know, if you'd like, I could share a couple of those with you.
I think I'm going to ask you about a couple of them. But first, I was curious, what is the standard metric that you judge yourself on? I know traditionally polls, I think, are off about 2.5 percentage points. So, I mean, is that the metric you're using, or is there something else that you're using as a marker you're shooting for?
As an industry, we're looking to be within 3 points.
Okay.
On a national poll, we're looking to be a little bit tighter than that, 2.5. You know, I think really from an industry standpoint, what's most disconcerting is that it was everyone in one direction. You know, if Don Levy got it wrong, but you know, two other polls had it wrong, let's say in the other direction, you would say, oh, that's interesting. You know, let's try to figure that out. That must be, you know, that Levy did something that was problematic, but you know, ABC or Fox, you know, they did something different. But insofar as everybody overstated Biden's performance relative to what has ultimately occurred. I mean, that said, you take a look at a state like Pennsylvania, which was polled by virtually everyone. You know, I'm looking here at a list that has, of the 10 pollsters I'm talking about, 9 of them did Pennsylvania, and all of them were between a 5 and 7 point projected margin in favor of Biden over Trump. The final margin in Pennsylvania at this point looks to be 1.2 points. So everybody was between 4 and 6 points in that direction. You know, that to us is not acceptable. You could say that, you know, if it was one poll, you take the margin of error, you double it, you would say, well, okay, you know, that can happen. But when it's every poll, that means that there was some sort of systemic phenomenon that took place that our polling did not accurately locate.
We're discussing the 2020 polls with Don Levy, director of the Siena College Research Institute. Well, now I want to run some of these potential theories by you, some of them of which I don't think are worth much merit, but I still think we need to fact check them at least. Heading into the election, commentators on the right were arguing that pollsters were basing their work on Democratic turnout that was too high, essentially saying, I'm projecting X number of Democrats and Y number of Republicans, and they said that the universe of Democrats was too high in those polls. What do you think of that idea? Did you accurately forecast the partisan makeup of the voters?
That's the way the party operatives think about it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't fit a percentage of you know, how many Republicans, how many Democrats are going to vote. That's just simply not the way we construct our likely voter models. It's the way they, you know, do their strategic work, and it makes sense to they. I think that when you look at the final makeup of our polls by partisanship, we had the appropriate number of Republicans, the appropriate number of Democrats. It's a question of whether we had ultimately the right ones. So I think that, you know, that accusation on the part of the parties, it makes sense to them, but it's not how we work.
Okay, here's another one. Because of COVID-19 and the increased use of mail-in ballots, it was going to be impossible to accurately project the 2020 elections.
I think that there's certainly a pandemic effect. We don't as yet have a real handle on how much of an effect it had. You know, one theory that's been bandied about is that the pandemic led to greater response rates in the spring and early summer. And as we approached the election, you know, there were people responding at a greater rate, leading us to believe that they were more enthusiastic than they turned out to be. I don't know. That one doesn't hold for me. The other one that's been expressed is that Democrats took the threat of the pandemic more seriously than did Republicans. Democrats tended to engage in early voting at rates far, far greater than Republicans. Republicans tended more to vote same day. And so the Democratic turnout, people could have told us in a poll that they were voting early, that they were absolutely certain, and one thing led to another, and they didn't get their mail-in ballot in on time, and then they didn't show up on election day. I don't, again, that's not one that that I'm subscribing to.
Undecided voters broke at the last second overwhelmingly for President Trump, and they weren't accounted for in the initial polling. You know, they were unaccounted for really in the days leading up, and that explains why Trump was able to outperform those final polls.
That's sort of a more traditional understanding of tight races. You know, what we found in our polls is that there simply weren't too many undecided voters. In fact, if you look back, interestingly, if you look back at the polls that we conducted in October of 2019, when we polled each of the six major battleground states, and we did it using ostensibly the exact same methodology, our polls were actually, in a year ahead of the election, far more accurate than the polls that we did in October of 2020. In fact, of the six key battleground states, we were right on in five of the six in a year before the election. So I think this is an election where it's not so much the undecided breaking, but it's the perhaps the lower enthusiasm voters who perhaps turned out at greater rates than anyone who may have been undecided, because there just simply weren't that many undecided.
Yeah, sticking with that, I guess, less enthusiastic voter turning out, you know, we did have drastically higher turnout this year. You, in the process of making your polls, gauge, you know, the enthusiasm of people and whether they're likely to actually turn out. Is it possible that it wasn't accurately gauged to predict the turnout numbers, and maybe the Republican numbers were off, the enthusiasm wasn't captured, and that's why their share of the electorate wasn't necessarily captured?
That's possible. Certainly, if you look at the voters who had voted in 2016, whether it's in our polls or exit polls, they pretty much stayed where they were in 2016. If you voted for Clinton in 2016, according to the exit polls, in the neighborhood of 95% of those voters voted for Biden. If you voted for Trump in 2016, it's about 93% of those voters voted for Trump in this election. So the difference came down to those people, perhaps, who did not vote in 2016, which is a combination of new voters and lower enthusiasm voters who voted in this election, but not in 2016. And within some demographic groups, most especially, you know, white voters without a college education, they appear to have turned out at a rate that was higher than we had polled. But again, that I think accounts for a relatively it's an interesting dynamic within the election, but it's a smaller impact on this field of polls, all of which tended to go one way and not the other way.
And after a quick break, we'll continue our review of the 2020 poll results with Don Levy, director of the Siena College Research Institute. When we get back from the break, we'll discuss the challenge of creating a representative sample, how the media should present information collected by polling, and how pollsters will reach voters in the future. Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare. We're continuing our review of the 2020 polls, and our guest is Don Levy, director of the Siena College Research Institute, a highly regarded polling outlet known for its partnership with the New York Times. So we've been going through the checklist of potential problems with polling this year, and the final one I have on my list is the type of people that you're reaching with your calls, which then serves as the basis for extrapolating out an entire demographic. Is there reason to believe that the people who are answering it maybe aren't representative of their demographics?
Well, you've come around to the one that I think is the one that explains this systematic overestimation of Biden's margin, and it really is multifaceted. In the first case, you take a look at the people that you did speak with. You know, as we talked about at length, we do these rigorous quotas, so we're looking for, you know, X number of white college-educated men or Y number of less than college-educated white women, you know, by regions. We're doing all those things. So, we believe that we had the appropriate demographic, but there was a tendency for the Biden supporter to be slightly more responsive to not only our poll, but polling in general, while at the same time, there was a tendency amongst the Trump supporter to be less responsive. We call it in our business non-response bias. You know, and the fact that we had, and we will continue to have, you know, the President Trump, who has made it clear that he feels the media and polling tends to be biased against him. And it makes sense that a certain small percentage of his supporters just simply said, I'm not going to participate. So we had the appropriate number of each demographic, but there was a slight tendency for us and ABC and CNN and Fox and so on, every poll, to be responded to by voters the probability that they were a Biden supporter was greater than exists in the general population. The non-response bias is what hit us. The other one that people talk about, and it's a little bit different, is what's been called the shy Trump voter, and that's more of a dynamic in which of people who are already on the phone with us, they are reluctant to tell us that they're voting for Trump for some reason, whether it's they don't want to say that to another person, they don't want to say it in front of another person, they don't want to press the button if it's an online poll. There may be a little bit of that. We're testing that as we speak in a poll that we're doing here in New York State that'll be out next week. We'll take a look at that shy Trump voter theory. But our view is that more than anything else, what pushed systematically 53 out of 57 polls in one direction was what we're calling non-response bias. That is the tendency of Trump supporters to not participate in polls, while simultaneously Biden supporters were perhaps slightly more likely to participate in polls.
So based on that, that means you're going to have to really amplify the Trump supporter in the future. They're going to have to be weighted more heavily because they're going to be reaching theoretically fewer of them, I guess. And I'm curious, in order to make sure that you're amplifying the right people or even just weeding out the shy Trump supporters who aren't, you know, making it clear that they support Trump, do you need to ask some additional questions to them? I mean, could questions about race or other issues linked to voting preference help weed out these voters that aren't really representative of their demographic?
Well, I mean, that's a great point, and certainly that's what we in the field are going to be working on. And some of the initial ideas are along those lines. One idea is that there's a relationship between the degree to which you have trust in government, trust in various institutions, and that if we asked a sequence of questions on the degree to which you trust your local government, your state government, your federal government, that might identify these folks who are disenchanted with any number of different societal institutions and then seek to weight them up. Another challenge that we face is this phenomenon related to Donald Trump? Or is this phenomenon now something that's going to continue, and it's present in conservatives? Is it more present in Republicans than it is in Democrats at this point in time? So to what degree is this going to change? We don't know. Is President Trump going to run for election in 2024? Then the dynamic might be similar. But what if he's not the candidate? The candidate is a more mainstream Republican in 2024, will we see this same phenomenon that certainly was, I think, amplified by the manner in which President Trump spoke and continues to speak about media and polling?
We're discussing the 2020 polls with Don Levy, director of the Siena College Research Institute. Do we, the media and the public, need to recalibrate how we read polls and what we take from them. And I ask this question with the 22nd Congressional District in New York as a backdrop. This is a central New York race between Democrat Anthony Brindisi and Republican Claudia Tenney. You projected Brindisi to be up 9 points in early October. And the big headline was Brindisi's up 9 points over Claudia Tenney. But I think less attention was paid to the fact that this lead was within the margin of error, and there was a percentage of voters who didn't really offer a response at that time. So how should we handle the information we get from polls?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and a conversation that we'll probably have with you and your colleagues moving forward. I think that there are polls that we conduct, and within any poll, we're also looking at a variety of issues and positions that voters and or citizens have about the important topics of the day. Those tend not to get as reported or as analyzed as, you know, what we call the horse race. And so we fixate on the horse race, and we don't do enough work to talk about margin of error, to talk about you know, the variance that can take place with a poll still being quote unquote right. If we look at issues more, it doesn't make as neat and clean a headline as candidate A up by 9 points over candidate B, but it might ultimately give us a better understanding, and it might ultimately be certainly 364 days out of the year. you know, I'm probably more focused on where people stand on the issues of the day, the social, cultural dynamics of the day, and providing that information, but it doesn't get covered. I mean, yesterday we released a poll on the upcoming holidays. We talked about what percentage of New Yorkers think that the worst of the coronavirus pandemic is over, the worst is still to come. We talked about the people's intended behavior relative to Thanksgiving, you know, or Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, et cetera. You know, and we release that. It probably gets written up in a handful of papers. I do 6, 7, 8 interviews. And it's important. It's important information. It's important to be discussed. And yet it doesn't get the kind of interest or coverage as did, you know, pre-election polls that focused almost entirely on a projected horse race margin. So, you know, my continuing hope is that you and I can, you know, work on a crusade to take the depth of the poll and project that in our coverage, at least to the same extent, if not more, than the coverage that goes simply to what kind of comes out like a sports score.
Phone calls to human beings, whether it's their landlines or their cell phones, are considered the gold standard in terms of collecting data for polls, but it's also extremely expensive. And I'm curious, moving forward, as money for polls becomes tighter and tighter, what other options are you exploring, and are you comfortable moving to some of these other options, including automated phone calls, online samples that are set up, and text messages that people receive where they can fill out their own surveys?
You know, we've spent a fair amount of time exploring multiple different options. I think that we are becoming progressively more comfortable, most especially with online polls. We haven't as yet come up with a texting process that we think works for us. You know, it's sort of interesting that the texting works best for straight up horse race polls. It's harder to do longer issues oriented polling via text. So, you know, while I'm intrigued by texting as a data collection mode, in a certain sense, it's less satisfying to me than online. At the same time, another methodology that we and other folks in our field will continue to work on is various forms of machine learning and artificial intelligence in which we would build models to project how the probabilities of certain types of voters to vote for candidate A or candidate B based on what we can learn about those people through other data streams. It's going to take a little while, I think, before either political parties and or candidates and or the media start to accept those sorts of projected models.
We only have about 1,400 days until the next presidential election. When do you think you'll have your first swing state poll in the field? Early December, or could it be as late as January of 2021?
Well, I think that it'll be a while, we decided not to pull the Georgia special, and we'll more than likely turn our attention to the New York City mayoral race, some of the county exec races, and then in a blink of an eye, we're going to have every single seat in Congress, and quite a few key Senate races will be up again. So we'll think about those before we think about the next presidential.
You mentioned that New York City mayoral race. How is ranked choice voting going to affect the way you look at that race?
Yeah, I mean, we've experimented with ranked choice in Maine.
Right.
That's one place that we've worked with it, and certainly it's going to have to factor into polling. It's also going to have to factor into to voters, whether voters are fully cognizant of how ranked choice voting is going to work and whether they've started to think about their vote in terms of number one, number two, or perhaps even number three. It will complicate our already complex little corner of the world that much more.
Well, I'm sure you'll figure it out, and you got plenty of time. We've been speaking with Don Levy, director of the Siena College Research Institute, a highly regarded polling outfit known for its partnership with the New York Times and its numerous appearances on the Capitol Press Room. Thanks so much for making the time, Don.
Always a pleasure, Dave. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Capitol Press Room, which you can take with you on the go wherever you download podcasts. Our engineer in Syracuse is Dave White. My producer in Albany is Tim Williams. I'm David Lombardo. Thanks for listening.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.